Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Welcome to today's podcast, everybody. I'm really pleased to have with me Carla Roberts, and she's Director of Legal Services at WTT Legal. And we're talking about statement of work today, which is a contractual arrangement when you're working as a self-employed person for your client. And Carla, just by way of a bit of background, she, prior to joining WTT, I think about 2 years ago, she's got lots of experience as a lawyer within the recruitment sector and has worked with quite a good number of high-profile recruitment firms. So you really know this contracting space very well, don't you, Carla?
Yes, I've been involved in staffing industry issues and compliance issues for a very long time, Julia.
we won't add up the number of years, but suffice to say, Carla knows. But suffice to say, Carla really knows her stuff. So and just on that, Carla is a qualified lawyer, but obviously the advice in today's podcast is general advice and obviously couldn't be relied upon in a court of law. So you are advised to seek any specifics to suit your particular circumstances. So just to be clear about that really at the outset. So Carla, starting off with the most obvious question probably, what actually is a statement of work?
Well, statement of work is a legally binding contract, which usually consists of what's called a master services agreement, also known as an MSA. And that is an overarching framework agreement that sets out the commercial and legal agreement between the two parties. Mm-hmm. And attached to that is a document called a statement of work. And that document is used to define and document a set of outcomes, objectives, or tasks for a project.
Okay.
It's also known as an outsourced service or a contracted out service. Many people call it just project services, or more commonly, it's called consultancy services.
Okay.
And it basically documents all the activity in detail that a supplier or a consultancy will provide for the end client, and all their responsibilities along with the duration of the project and the engagement, and specifying exactly how payments are made. So basically that's it in a nutshell. It's a legally binding document.
Okay. And just for the purposes of our listeners, we've got some self-employed people who are listeners and also contractors who work a lot through recruitment firms, and the recruitment firms find them their work. And I guess this statement of work legal document is applicable for both types of person, isn't it?
Absolutely. Either the agency themselves can deliver the services,
yeah,
rather than delivering just traditional staffing services, which is resourcing a candidate, filling a role, vetting the candidate, and then turning it over to the contractor and the client to complete the project. Or the contractor can engage directly with an end client under a statement of work.
Okay. Okay.
So there's two different models. Either the agency can deliver a statement of work themselves, but of course that's completely different from what traditional staffing agencies generally do. So they need to check with their insurers to make sure that that model is covered, because obviously it's going to involve a lot more risk,
yeah,
since they're actually delivering the services themselves. But we'll get into those risks a little bit later.
Okay. Okay, so how does a statement of work differ from other types of contract when someone's being engaged by their client?
Statement of work is entirely different from a traditional contract. And the main difference is that it is a genuinely outsourced service. So as I explained before, with a traditional agency or staffing contract. Mm. The agency will be responsible for sourcing, for payrolling the contractor, for checking suitability. And in those circumstances, the client owns the outcome. The contractor's paid hourly or weekly on a time and material basis. Okay. And generally, that contractor is considered working on an outside IR35 basis. With an SOW, a client is entirely outsourcing the service to the provider or the consultancy. So that consultancy is responsible for the entire service, meeting specific deadlines, complying with any milestones that might be set out, and they are paid on a fixed price basis on meeting specified acceptance criteria. So in these circumstances, the consultancy owns the outcome.
Okay.
So the resource makeup of an SOW is almost irrelevant because you can use either a single person or a multi-person team. And it's the actual outcomes that are relevant. Whereas with a traditional outside IR35 contractor, you're placing a limited company with a designated individual.
Okay.
So I think that is really the big difference between those two types of contracts. One is the provision of a service. The other is the provision of a person through a limited company.
Okay, then that's really helpful. And you've mentioned IR35. Now, we're not going to get into that today, which you'll probably be relieved to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
but just to say for our listeners, we have covered IR35 previously. So I will put a link to the IR35 episodes alongside this podcast. And there are actually two of them because it's such a big topic. So just in case anyone listening was wondering what the heck we're talking about, we have got it covered, and there's a resource there for you to listen to whenever suits. So in terms of the statement of work, what are the kind of pros and cons of it? I mean, I guess we are going to now have to touch back on IR35 because that is one of the driving forces as to why it's being talked about at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are getting a lot of inquiries from contractors who have been advised by the end client they will no longer engage traditional contractors.
Okay.
So the big pro of a statement of work is that end clients are generally willing to consider a contractor working under a statement of work.
Okay.
And so the transitioning from a time and materials basis to an outcome-based arrangement is obviously going to present all sorts of opportunities, as well as risks, which we'll talk about in a minute, to these private sector consultancies. And of course, when it's done compliantly, it's totally exempt from off payroll.
Okay.
Again, we'll go into that, I think, probably a little bit later when we talk about how it needs to work. Demand for projects delivered by a consulting firm under a genuine SOW could definitely increase exponentially, I think, as volumes of work are displaced by this new regime. Because if clients aren't willing to engage contractors in the traditional outside IR35 PSC model, a lot of clients are instead engaging true, genuine outsourced consultancies to deliver, because the work still needs to be done.
Yeah.
So this model is attractive mainly to the client because it removes all IR35 risks from them.
Okay.
Absolutely. It's entirely out of scope. And I think a lot of clients are attracted to this model because a lot of clients do not have adequate expertise to properly deal with IR35 compliance. Either they don't have an in-house compliance team or a legal team. So they've just decided they don't want the hassle. They don't want the tax risks. And, you know, we talked about blanket assessments last year. We're not seeing a lot of those being made because I think clients understand that they need to take reasonable care when they're making an assessment. However, they some of them are just saying they're not going to take any traditional contractors at all. Another reason that SOWs are beneficial is that SOWs tend to increase when the economy declines.
Okay.
So the clients might need to reduce their headcount.
Yeah.
But as I said before, the project work still needs to be done. For agencies, I think delivering an SOW themselves is less bureaucratic than trying to get on a client's PSL. Because generally, these type of projects are dealt by business units rather than HR. So there tends to be less red tape for an agency if they want to deliver the services on a consultancy basis.
Okay.
I mean, the big one, the big advantage for consultancies and working under statement of work is that you can charge a much higher price than time and materials.
Because you're taking more risk, I guess.
You're taking more risk. So you have to take those risks into account when you're pricing the work. Because obviously your insurance risks, the fact that you may need to rectify defective work, the project may get delayed, you need to pay your subcontractors perhaps on time and material basis. So you definitely need to price that. So, you know, there tends to be quite a bit of padding with SOW work as compared to being paid on a time and material basis.
Okay.
So those are definitely, you know, the big pros.
And it sounds to me like the SOW is really much more of a commercial business to business agreement than perhaps what's gone before, which perhaps might have been more about an individual person. So it's about kind of getting that clarity as to what work is being delivered rather than just a different type of contract that is, as you say, paid on time and materials, which is you paid by the hour. The main difference here is you're paid by deliverables.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, that this is a true business to business arrangement. Now, obviously, when a limited company is engaging with an agency or going direct to a client, it is also a business-to-business arrangement.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of those arrangements are more akin to an employment relationship, not a business-to-business arrangement, which is why HMRC have brought in these new rules to toughen up, you know, tax law. And to ensure that everybody is paying the right amount of tax. So clearly working on an SOW basis, as long as it's done properly, is a proper business-to-business arrangement. And I think in a lot of countries, there's no kind of in-between ambiguous PSC sort of arrangement. You either work as a freelancer on an SOW basis or you're a PAYE temp.
Okay.
And I think that's the trend here now.
Yeah. So it's because this way of working is on the increase at the moment because we've got these people that are contractors who are working on a time and materials basis, but actually perhaps they should be working on a more B2B basis. You're right. We've got this kind of section of the contingent workforce that is something in between, and I suppose this straightens that out in essence, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the intention.
Okay.
Is to make the distinction a lot clearer between the different ways of working.
Yeah, okay. And what are the risks of a statement of work? So I'm guessing if I've previously been working for a bank through my own limited company doing an IT project, for example, and I've previously been not on a statement of work but being paid on an hourly or daily rate. If I then want to transition to a statement of work, what is the risk to me, that individual person?
Well, I think that's a very good comparison to make, really good example to give, actually, because you can't shoehorn every time a materials engagement into a statement of work. And when we talk to contractors who are considering this model, we will do an SOW risk assessment with them to make sure that they are already comfortably working outside IR 35, and more importantly, that they're used to working on a project basis and used to deliverables and are comfortable with the idea of being paid on a fixed price basis.
Okay.
So yeah, absolutely. This does not suit every type of engagement. And I think HMRC will certainly be on the lookout for previous assignments with the same client that have been shoehorned into a new sort of model. If the payment mechanism hasn't drastically changed, okay. And that's the most important criteria, is that the consultant or the contractor is now taking some financial risk, whereas previously he probably wasn't. He may have taken out insurance, mm-hmm. Package amount of insurance for 30 or 40 pounds a year. But we're talking about real financial risk now, where you're being paid a fixed price, not hourly or weekly. Mm. So you need to wait until you've hit those milestones and it's been accepted before you get paid. So that's what constitutes financial risk. And also, you still are required to pay your subs on time and material quite often in these arrangements. So you might need to even get financing. There's also more contractual risks, because your clients are going to expect you to sign up to all sorts of indemnities for data protection, confidentiality, breach of bribery. I mean, all the usual indemnities. But we're finding that quite often these indemnities are either capped at a very high level or completely uncapped for certain categories of losses, and no exclusions for certain types of losses, such as indirect and consequential losses. So that is a big financial risk. Okay. As I've alluded to before, contractors are required to remedy defective services, mm-hmm. and they often need to provide a warranty period. Some clients will request unlimited warranty for latent defects.
Wow.
So we would always encourage contractors to scrutinize their contracts very, very closely, get legal advice, and push back on any unlimited warranties and try to restrict it to, say, a 3-month period.
Yeah.
And to make sure, of course, that any defects are related to the provision of the services. So they're inherent defects as opposed to just being latent defects.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
We also talked about insurance and the fact that it is relatively cheap for a contractor, but for SOW services, it tends to be more expensive, because naturally you're taking more risk, you're accepting indemnities. Things tend to go wrong more often. So contractors will find that they will need to pay more for insurance. And then also quite often are required to obtain industry specific insurance,
right?
Such as track line or offshore or nuclear insurance, and tend to attract higher limits.
Yeah.
So, these are a lot of considerations that need to be really, really looked at closely.
Yeah. And I hadn't realized that some clients were looking for unlimited warranties. And that strikes me as a bit unreasonable on their part, but I'm not, that's just my opinion.
Obviously, it's a business to business arrangement. So both parties are going to try to insert terms that are most advantageous to them.
Yeah.
So we are seeing unlimited warranties. Wow. And unless you define the scope of that warranty, then, you could potentially be exposing yourself to a lawsuit 3 or 4 years down the line when your services are tampered with by third parties and probably the client themselves.
Wow.
So, it's really important to not only limit the duration of the warranty, but to include a clause in the contract to make it very, very clear that you are not going to indemnify them for anything that is not your fault.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're all guilty from time to time of kind of signing documents without properly reading them. So, I mean, this, I would hope no listeners would sign something like this without properly reading it. But if listeners take nothing else away from this conversation, that warranty point is hugely, hugely important.
Read your contract.
And don't anyone listening just sign a contract without reading it. That is... that's bananas in this day and age.
Absolutely. Even if the writing is in very small font, just enlarge it.
Yes, exactly. Is this kind of statement of work type of contractual arrangement, is it kind of the magic bullet that some people are suggesting in relation to the off-payroll changes that are coming in April? And, you know, we've touched on reasons as to why it might be. And I think, you know, for some circumstances. You tell me. I'm starting to answer the question. Not me.
I think you've answered it yourself. Absolutely not. I mean, working to an SOW is not suitable for everyone who previously had their own PSC. You can't just shoehorn a time and materials contract into a fixed price.
Yeah.
So you need to completely renegotiate all terms with the client, and it is only suitable to project-based work.
Yeah.
An SOW is out of scope of IR35, but putting one in place to avoid IR35 is a big risk.
Yeah.
Particularly if the service your company provides and how it is delivered remains the same as before.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think also you need to recognize the fact that if you're a large consultancy, as defined under the Companies Act, you will become the client for the purposes of off-payroll. Yes. You will have to conduct the status determination statements on your contractors. However, if you're a small consultancy, and I think that's less than 10.2 million turnover and less than 50 employees.
Yeah, that sounds right to me.
Then you will be entitled to small company exemption and the old rules apply, which means all your subcontractors will need to do their own assessments. But there's no doubt HMRC will be looking for sham SOWs. Yeah. In fact, the HMRC internal staff manual provides some really good example of what they believe constitutes a sham arrangement.
Okay.
And they'll go after the client as well if it's deemed a sham. And of course, the client will then be looking to enforce those tax indemnities.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, if you are providing a genuinely contracted out service under a statement of work, then the off-payroll rules will not apply.
Okay. And I mean, I don't know whether you're seeing many recruitment agencies looking to set themselves up as a consultancy and have statements of work, or is the trend more about the individual contractors having a statement of work directly with the client? I mean, how are you seeing that pan out in the recruitment agency world?
Well, I think the larger recruitment companies have seen this on the horizon for quite a few years.
Mm.
I was head of legal for a large company specializing in engineering services.
Okay.
Back in 2011, they set up a project-based division.
Right.
So they've seen this coming as their larger clients have asked for this type of model.
Mm.
I think it's the smaller agencies now that are grappling with whether or not this is appropriate for their business and whether they can afford to do it.
Mm.
Because, you know, as we've alluded to before, it involves a lot of upfront expense in terms of, you know, payment and insurance and the fact that you are not going to get paid on a regular basis.
Mm.
But the trend from my perspective has been from small contractors who are looking to form a small consultancy and deliver direct to the end client.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And most of the contractors have been told by their agency that they either need to go umbrella or direct on the agency payroll. And if they don't like that alternative, if they've been doing contracting a long time and don't want to be paid PAYE for whatever the reason is, then this is the option that they're considering now.
Okay, so we're seeing groups of contractors say who work on IT projects with different skills on different bits. I don't know why I'm obsessed by IT today, by the way, obviously.
IT tends to be very conducive to transferring and transitioning. The type of model, just because it tends to be project-based work.
Yeah, Yeah. So I guess we're seeing someone who's skilled in a particular type of programming, maybe teaming up with someone else who's skilled in a different type, and they work together on the same project, and they may then set up a consultancy rather than recruitment agencies looking to really massively overhaul their business, wouldn't they? And you know, they might not even
entirely different model.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a really interesting and helpful point for our listeners. And what are kind of the most important things that should be considered where if you're looking to work through with a statement of work arrangement?
Well, I think if you're considering transitioning to statement of work, I think you need to consider how the work is actually provided.
Okay.
For example, to what extent do the workers interact with client staff? How is payment for the project structured? Is it fixed fee based on the achievement of milestones, acceptance, or criteria? Is the supplier solely responsible for managing the resources? And that is crucial that the client has no involvement with respect to what subcontractors you engage. Who do the workers report or liaise with?
Yeah.
Can the client request the services of a specific individual? And who would be notified if there were any defects or problems with the services? So I think those are the main considerations that you need to look at if you're looking to transition. But with respect to the three most important things, I would say that you need to ensure that it's a genuinely outsourced service and that the contract reflects the working practices.
Yeah.
You need to ensure that you priced it correctly to cover all the risks that we've been talking about. You don't want to end up bankrupting yourself over this. And you need to ensure that the scope is clear on the SOW, that exactly what you're doing is clear and unambiguous. And more importantly, what is not covered, because that is where we find the biggest potential for risk. Yeah. With respect to dispute.
Okay.
So I'd say those three things, and of course, being careful with your tax indemnity.
Yeah.
Would be the big issues to consider before signing any contract.
Okay, and that's really helpful because changing from one way of working to another is actually a significant change, and it's really important to get that right. And the other point to make in relation to this is you sort of touched on it a bit there, but the scope being really, really important. And I guess it is a business to business arrangement. So therefore, if the scope starts to creep, would it be right to then renegotiate an addendum or something like that to add on to the contract to show that the scope of the work being done is changing?
Well, obviously getting it right in the first instance, making sure that the scope provides an overview of the whole project, the engagement, the set of outcomes required, and providing as much detail as possible is so, so important. If you start encountering scope creep, which is exactly what it's called, then, of course, there's the opportunity to invoke the change control process.
Right.
So you need to make sure you've got one of those. And in the event you don't, you need at least an expert determination procedure before you get involved in any sort of dispute resolution. But the more detail, the better. Okay. And as I said before, definitely outlining what is not covered will help to prevent any sort of dispute in the future. Okay.
It sounds like there's actually quite a lot of work to do in planning the project to quite a bit more level of detail than perhaps people might have been used to beforehand. So it does sound like it's well worth, well, it sounds to me like it's essential actually to get all of that really, really clear at the outset before entering into the arrangement. And I guess you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, statements of works tend to follow a template, which includes the client requirements, the solution overview, the scope. And as we've talked about before, that's probably the most important section.
Yeah.
The deliverables, which is the actual output required by the supplier as part of the engagement. And then the milestone, which details the measurement of progress against the outcomes.
Yeah.
Talking about the project team, so identifying who from the supplier and who from the client will be representing both parties.
Mm-hmm.
The acceptance criteria, talking exactly about what constitutes acceptance, how quickly the client has to accept the work or ask for it to be rectified.
Yeah.
Also, what's important is listing any client dependencies. So
okay.
generally defines and details what you expect the client to provide in terms of support.
Yeah.
So that you can successfully complete an outcome or a milestone.
Yeah.
And finally, is just caveats and assumptions, which are just a set of conditions which we will likely include in SOW, just to measure the deliverables and milestones, I guess. And I also want to mention that there's usually a special terms section at the very end. And this is a really, really important section because generally the way the MSA is structured is to state that any special terms in the SOW
mm-hmm.
will take precedence over any terms in the MSA. So okay. if there's anything different from what's in the MSA on this particular project, you will need to insert that in the special terms section, and that will override any other legal conditions
okay.
or obligations in the MSA.
Okay, that's a really important point. And when you were saying about the kind of things to include in the statement of work, there was a few points there that I thought worth picking out, which was in relation to if you're being paid on an outcomes basis, which is really what this way of working is all about, then one of the things you said was about it being clear as to clients' acceptance criteria. And I guess you don't want to be in a situation where you're waiting for the client to tell you it's okay, and essentially they might be delaying payment as well because they haven't come back to you to tell you that. And I guess there's all these other different nuances in that pay, like alongside getting paid. You know, so you could deliver the perfect project and your client might never sign it off, and then you don't get paid. So
yeah, so you need to specify that the client will accept the work within 5 days, for
yeah.
example.
Yeah.
Or the work will be deemed accepted.
Yes. I like that, actually. As you know, sorry, client, if you don't come back to me either way, right. we will assume it is accepted, and then they can issue an invoice and expect payment then. Yeah. Yeah.
Or if they put the work to commercial use.
Yeah.
That's another exception. Yeah. So it's really, really important to get the acceptance criteria very, very clear and unambiguous. Otherwise, you're sitting there waiting for payment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
may never come.
Exactly. So, I mean, there is quite a lot of legal detail to be considered in this. And I think one of the things you touched on earlier, which I did want to just reemphasize, was around HMRC being aware that people might be putting together statement of works that are perhaps not a genuine reflection as to what goes on in reality. And I don't know if the term sort of sham contract would be applicable there, but I guess it's a cautionary tale to make sure that whatever your contract is reflective of the work being done. And if it is completely different to how you actually work, then you're at risk of a potential tax case in relation to IR35 and off payroll legislation. And I assume I've understood that correctly, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And basically the same principles with respect to IR35 apply here. So if you're yeah. working on an outside IR35 basis, you need to ensure that your working practices reflect the contractual terms. You need to have an IR35 review done on a regular basis. And the same thing applies here. You need to make sure that your working practices reflect the contractual terms.
Yeah.
And quite likely they will do. I mean, if you're being paid on a fixed price basis, that's not something that you're going to be deviating from.
No.
But I think the biggest issue is payment, because a lot of contractors are going to struggle to transition from time and materials to fixed price. Mm. And they will want to have a statement of work paid on time and materials. Whilst it can be done, in certain circumstances, for example, where the scope of the project hasn't really been defined, so you can do a certain amount of work on time and materials, a true consultancy outsourced services needs to be paid on fixed price. I mean, although one way that a time and materials project can be done is if some payment is withheld. Okay. So even though you're being paid on an hourly basis, if there's, say, 25% retention, so that you can demonstrate you have taken that financial risk. Mm. That is what fixed price payment is all about. It's taking that financial risk.
Yeah,
you're not get paid until the work's done and the client is happy with it. So if you are working on time and materials, which should be the exception, not the rule, I would strongly urge that a consultancy has some way to demonstrate they are taking financial risk by having some retention.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And again, because of what we just said, that it could otherwise appear to be not a genuine reflection of how things are working in practice. This whole area sounds really complicated to me. And I think probably some of our listeners are just like, don't prioritize working through their contractual arrangements. But I guess one of the really important messages I'm taking from our conversation is you've got to look at this and you know, you've got to be clear how you're working and what is in those contracts. So I think I would probably close with sort of saying to our listeners, get some legal advice. There are loads of advisors out there. And if you are looking to work on a statement of work basis, you absolutely need to get some legal advice from people that know this stuff. Otherwise, you'll find you've signed up to an unlimited warranty. And that's what I'm going to be having nightmares about. But is there anything you would add to that?
No, I think that is some very good advice that you've just given. Really important, if you're working on a true business-to-business basis, that you scrutinize your contract very, very closely, or you will end up paying in the long term for it. If you sign up to onerous terms.
Yeah. And, you know, we as I say, we're all guilty of that to some extent. And I'm now worried about what I've signed up to for my mobile phone and who knows what, quite apart from this, which is probably complex. So so thank you so, so much for joining us today, Carla. We're really, really pleased to have your expertise. And I think we will tap into your expertise again at some point in the future, because there's all sorts of stuff I can see that our listeners will be interested in your view on. So massive thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Nice speaking to you, Julia.
Thank you for listening to Empowering Agency Workers, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.